Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, we're going to take a look at the Lucasfilm legacy of Kathleen Kennedy. Kennedy, of course, was George Lucas's handpicked successor to run Lucasfilm after Disney's $4 billion purchase of that brand that included primarily Star Wars, but also Indiana Jones and some other stuff. Matthew Bellany at Puck reported that she will be stepping away from Lucasfilm soonish, likely to be announced within months, maybe toward the end of the year, but would keep making movies under her own banner, prompting much speculation about who will replace her, and also prompting a very classic non-denial denial from Kennedy, who told Mike Fleming at Deadline that she was not going to stop making movies. That's definitely not a rejection of what Bellany reported, folks had told him. Anyway, regardless, now seems like a good time, as good a time as ever, to discuss her legacy. Matt Osborne, writing in Substack, summed up the negative case pretty negatively by decrying her efforts to make the Force female, as a t-shirt Kennedy wore during the release of The Force Awakens proudly proclaimed, and the franchise's decision to lean into, you know, the whole woke, it's too woke now, with their shows about their lesbian space witches and no more boy-girl relationships, etc. On top of that, her failures at the executive level have led to what feel like dozens of projects being announced and abandoned. And then there was the disastrous effort to renew the Indiana Jones franchise with Phoebe Waller-Bridge supposedly going to take over the tan fedora from Harrison Ford, who was ready to hang it up, a little bit old. And you have what looks like a pattern, right? This is like, I'm quoting, I'm not endorsing here, but it's the whole go woke, go broke thing, right? The maximalist case against Kennedy always ignores her producing career alongside Steven Spielberg and Amblin. And that is hugely successful. I don't think you can ignore everything else that she's done there and just discuss the Lucasfilm side of it. But also, it really ignores Star Wars' successes since the sale. And these have not been slight. I am by no means a Kathleen Kennedy defender, but I think it's unfair to write her off as a complete failure without noting at least the three following things. The Force Awakens remains the highest grossing film domestically ever released. Not adjusted for inflation, etc. But still, highest grossing domestic release ever. That's not nothing. Rogue One was a shocking success. It earned $1 billion worldwide despite late reshoots and rewrites by Tony Gilroy, who would go on to do the most critically acclaimed of the Star Wars TV shows, Andor. But that success, that huge $1 billion success, showed that Star Wars could be a force beyond the, you know, main trilogy that they were working on, right? It showed that there was a lot of potential there. And then you have The Mandalorian, which probably drove tens of millions of subscriptions to Disney Plus, which makes it potentially, I wouldn't say definitely, but potentially the single most profitable Star Wars entry in the whole series. If you look at it that way. Now, of course, it's always hard to say, well, did they sign up for this, something else, whatever. But I think you could argue, you could make the case that The Mandalorian is the most profitable Star Wars thing ever made. And that's before you take into account all the Baby Yoda merch sales. I'm sorry, Grogu. All the Grogu sales. That said, everything else about the franchise has been kind of a disaster over the last 10 years, right? The execution of The Last Jedi and The Rise of Skywalker was poor, and it was poor because there was nobody at the executive level guiding the series to a satisfying conclusion. There was no unity between the three films. Rian Johnson immediately set out to undo everything J.J. Abrams had done before him. Then J.J. Abrams gets in, and he's like, no, I'm going to undo all of that. I'm going to put all my stuff back in. And all of this happened because Colin Trevorrow got kicked out of the director's chair months before shooting was supposed to start. The whole thing's been a mess. Watching those three, you watch those three films back to back to back, it's like watching somebody having a schizophrenic episode. It's just all over the place.
It's TV like a podcast shows, with three hosts.
It's not like that at all, because at least we are in conversation with each other. We're not just, you know, anyway.
And with the same TV people shows, week to week, too.
Maybe. The TV shows. All right, let's set the movies aside. Set aside the enormous flop of Solo and the mess there of getting rid of Lord and Miller, you know, halfway through shoots and bringing in Ron Howard. Just look at the TV shows, right? The Mandalorian aside, the TV shows are a mess. They please few members of the general audience. The overall audience share has been declining series after series. It's gotten to the point where even I, a fairly compulsive Star Wars consumer, seriously, talk to me sometimes about the Star Wars collectible card game I've been playing with my kids, all right? I haven't even watched Ahsoka or the aforementioned lesbian space witch show, The Acolyte. For every show that gets made, it feels like three movies or TV shows are announced and then canceled. This is a problem at the executive level. It's not at the execution level. It's not at the thematic level. It's not at the, you know, we're making stuff, but it's not that good. It's at purely at the executive level. These are failures. She needs to be held accountable for them at some level, all right? And one thing that the Kennedy critics are absolutely right about is that criticisms of her tenure are too frequently waved away as if by Jedi mind trick by folks who say that any criticism of her is rooted in sexism, that they're just the bad fans. It's the bad fans who want to return the franchise to its boys club roots. And you get a little bit of that in that Osborne piece. And in a way, this is how the whole Kennedy fight serves as a broader proxy for the culture war writ large, right? There are a number of reasonable complaints to be made about her, and the people making the complaints are often dismissed as nothing but bigots. And that drives people way crazier than saying, well, no, you're wrong for this reason, that reason. There's this. It's a problem for honest discussion and debate about Star Wars, but also just society in general. It's bad for society to do that. Peter, what do you make of Kathleen Kennedy's tenure and the way we talk about it?
I think Kathleen Kennedy's loudest critics are often too mean-spirited. They overread some of the kind of evidence, especially where it sort of comes to the, oh, she's too woke argument, right? They're too willing to believe kind of conspiratorial things that have not actually been reported or pinned down. But they're in a lot of ways directionally correct. Because yes, The Force Awakens was a huge hit. And the reason it was a huge hit is because there was a huge, huge pent-up demand for Star Wars. And that's what The Force Awakens demonstrated, that you could tap that pent-up demand. And then what Kathleen Kennedy did for the next decade or so is slowly shrink that demand and make, right? And like, this is, it's not just that she announced all these projects that didn't happen. And it's not just that she has been sort of flighty and sort of not able to like stick with her own decisions, as in the case of Solo, most particularly where she, the movie was sort of shot and then reshot. I mean, they were more than halfway through their shooting schedule when they fired the director and then completely brought in like a new team and rebuilt it from the ground up. I mean, it's a almost totally different movie than the one we were supposed to get. Now, what she did was she just slowly sapped the demand for that movie. And this is the thing that I think she is most responsible for. Like, this is the biggest sort of knock against her is Star Wars isn't as popular now. And she took the surest possible thing in Hollywood. She took a franchise that should have been, as long as it just sort of okay. Just all you had to do was be okay. Deliver something like the promise of what Star Wars, deliver on the promise of Star Wars, basically with everything you release. You can make $1 billion every time. And they had this plan. There was a story in Wired that I recall from around when Disney acquired Star Wars, where the plan was going to be a movie every year. Well, they released 5 movies, and every time they released a movie, like the interest got a little bit less. Yes, I like Rogue One, and I think actually of the 5 feature films, I like it more now than when I saw it in the theater, actually. I think it sort of stood up better in my mind. And I really like Andor. And so I will say there are a couple of products here that came out well, but far too many of these things just don't work in the sense of driving. Like she took the helm of the biggest cultural ship that existed, and she shrunk it. She let like she shrunk the ship. I don't, what am I, like, everybody left. Everybody jumped ship. The thing started sinking under her watch. And part of that, I think, is, you know, she embraced a kind of cultural politics in Star Wars that just didn't work for the fans. But I don't think that's, you know, we've discussed this on the show so many times. As I've said before, like, you look at Spider-Verse films. Like, those are pretty woke identitarian films, explicitly so. If you look at what the creators have talked about in terms of how they, like, you know, they won the Oscar one year and they were like, this is about diversity and representation. Those are great movies. And they work for Spider-Man fans because they're great movies that actually capture the appeal of Spider-Man. So it's not necessarily the case that, you know, being sort of more woke or whatever word we're going to use there is a death knell for these kind of previously boys franchises. But she wasn't able to integrate that sort of politics in a way that also produced good movies, good TV shows that drove interest and made people want to see more films and more stories. And then the other thing is, as you said, she just couldn't get all these projects across the line. It is insane to me that there are at least, just off the top of my head, what, 5, 6 announced projects, including Patty Jenkins's X-Wing, like, Squadron movie, that where she, like, made a video in front of a bunch of fighters and talked about her dad and was like, I'm going to make this movie. And that movie's not happening. None of these movies are happening. Crazy.
Alyssa, this is the nub of it, right? Is that, like, it's one thing to make things and then the fans don't like them. That happens. You make things and sometimes they don't work, and that's just part of the show. I would say the biggest problem is the not making things. The biggest problem with Star Wars under her tenure here is that since 2019 there hasn't been a Star Wars movie in theaters, right? Since 2019, you have not had one. There's not going to be another one until the Grogu and Mandalorian movie that is coming out next year at some point. And so that's going to be 7 years if it comes out. In the meantime, you've had a Lando project get announced and kind of shelved, and supposedly it's still being worked on. You've had the Taika Waititi trilogy of films that was announced and kind of went away. There's some sort of mysterious Rian Johnson trilogy that was announced and never really came to fruition. There's the Patty Jenkins X-Wing Rogue Squadron one, right? There was a Kevin Feige project maybe that was being worked on. And, like, again, any one of these in isolation, it's like projects fall apart. That happens. That thing that happens. But, like, to have them all fall apart all the time is a C-suite problem. That's an executive level problem.
Yeah. And look, I don't know which of us on this podcast is, like, the biggest Star Wars dork. I'm probably that person. Like, as the person who's, like, pen-palled, like, Star Wars fan fiction level geek, I am probably the person who was most excited about the resurrection of the franchise. And I think probably the one who's been most deeply disappointed by it, just because it was so my pop cultural urtext, right? I mean, especially as someone who is not super engaged with a lot of other pop culture, Star Wars was, like, kind of the exception. And I think to a certain extent, you're right, Sunny. And I think in particular, part of what's a bummer is that, like, some of the things that people got excited about and that never came to fruition were the ones that seemed to most directly understand, you know, the appeal of Star Wars. But I do think the people who are criticizing the Kennedy era for kind of not getting what Star Wars was all about have a point. And I think that is particularly true in the sense that Star Wars was a movie about grown-up relationships, right? Like, the original trilogy is, in not insignificant part, a screwball romantic comedy, right? I mean, Harrison Ford and Carrie Fisher bicker their way across the universe, you know, smooch in absolutely ridiculous circumstances, like, get back together in absolutely ridiculous circumstances. Like, that sort of grown-up, you know, romantic dynamic was actually important to the movies, right? Like, yes, it's a coming-of-age story. It's a hero's journey, you know, Luke Skywalker, you know, sort of late teens, early 20s, blah, blah, blah. But, like, his is only one of the arcs in the movie. And one of the reasons that I really enjoyed, like, the Star Wars novelizations and comics and things as a kid was because they weren't just teenage stories, right? I mean, you know, if Patty Jenkins had made sort of a rough adaptation of like the X-Wing books that were written. You know, those are all stories about grownups who, you know, are dealing with sort of big political questions, but also big romantic questions as well. Part of what was fun about that expanded universe was kind of getting to see characters like Luke Skywalker grow up. Like, what is Luke Skywalker like as a husband? What is he like as a dad? And I do think, you know, there is a larger problem in our franchises of sexlessness, kind of an adolescent approach to relationships. You know, that's sort of like the closest that the Marvel Cinematic Universe, you know, you've got like Tony and Pepper Potts, you've got Ant-Man and the Wasp, but, you know, these are very, very sort of adolescent, like surface level takes on relationships.
There was a whole complaint about this, like that burbled up during the pandemic when there were no Marvel movies for a couple of years, and the Eternals came out, and there was that huge deal about how like there's a kiss, and yeah. It's the most chaste. Yeah. Like it was anti-romantic.
Yeah,
it was anti-sexy. It was anti like adult relate. Like it somehow or another, like I won't say what it made me want to do, but definitely not what a good romantic sequence will make me want to do.
And look, I think, you know, part of the appeal of Star Wars is that it takes, you know, the like Buck Rogers serials and takes, you know, a in some ways very adolescent genre and uses it to explore adult concerns, you know, like politics, like relationships, like, you know, frankly, you know, with all the Jedi stuff, like religion. And the pairing of that, you know, sort of form and substance made for just an interesting, fun tension. And, you know, I think there's no mistake that sort of Andor, which I think probably all of us agree is the best part of the Kennedy era. I mean, The Mandalorian is fun. So say like The Mandalorian and Andor are in some ways sort of the most politically and engaged and most willing to deal with sort of adult concerns. What are your obligations, you know, in The Mandalorian? Like, what are your obligations to your community, to a certain extent, like your religious faith? In Andor, you know, what are the actual costs of being in a rebellion? And what are the ways in which someone sort of comes to politics? And so, you know, I do think there was a loss of fun and a loss of sort of adult sensibility at the same time that I think has made the Kennedy era a failure often as kid entertainment and a failure as adult entertainment. And that's a real bummer. And I say that as, you know, one of those dorky girls who grew up on Princess Leia, and to have a, you know, an attempt at the franchise that was so clearly targeted at people like me be such a failure has been just really globally disappointing.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting, too, because I've got two kids. One is 9, going on 10. The other is 6. They are like prime Star Wars age, and they watch the old Star Wars movies. They watch A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. They are not interested really in the new TV shows. I was like, hey, you want to watch Skeleton Crew, which is like kind of the kiddie Amblin style, you know, adventure show that's the new one from John Watts. And they were kind of like, yeah, okay. But they weren't that into it.
No one was that into it. I was just looking. It is the lowest watched Star Wars show, period. Lower than the lesbian space witches show.
Nobody, and this is the problem, right? This is the problem with the franchise. You spend $4 billion on a franchise and it needs to come out regularly and be of interest to a general audience. And that interest has totally collapsed. And there, I think some of the grief that Kathleen Kennedy takes is unfair, but I think that she has to bear a large portion of the responsibility for that fact. And it's nobody could fail like this at the executive level and get a pass. You just can't do it.
Yeah. I have to say, by the way, that I did not even realize that The Acolyte was about lesbian space witches, which makes me much more interested in that show.
I think they're not technically lesbians. Everyone just calls them lesbian space witches because they, I don't want to get into the mechanics of it. But
are they like anti-male space witches? Are they like separatist space witches?
I think they're Sith space witches who used Force to bring about. Anyway,
so
I don't want to.
It's, you know, I haven't seen the show, so
the
I can't
show.
Tell you.
I haven't watched the show. I don't know. I can't tell you.
So maybe there's some like obvious in-text reason, and maybe it's just exaggerated. At least part of it is the show's creator.
Yes, she is. Yes. Anyway, All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy? The way we talk about Kathleen Kennedy's tenure, also Kathleen Kennedy's tenure. Alyssa?
I think it is a controversy. Yeah, I think it's a controversy.
Peter?
It's all controversial. She didn't quite totally fail, but I think that she has not done the job. She has made Star Wars less popular. She has taken huge pent-up demand, and that demand is no longer as huge. It's probably still pretty big, but it's no longer as big, and that's a problem. I also think that some of the critics misunderstand what she has done badly.
Yeah, I think that's fair. That's a fair way to put it. It's controversial all around, but, you know, I think, look, I can't say for sure that the franchise will be better without her. Who knows what happens next? I do not have the power of sight beyond sight, but...
I thought when you ousted the person that you don't like who's in charge of things, everything just magically gets better.
Yeah, that's actually how politics works. We're seeing all that right now. All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus for our bonus episode on Friday, where we're going to be discussing hyperliteralism at the movies. Speaking of hyperliteralism at the movies, on to the main event. Mickey 17, starring Robert Pattinson as Mickey Barnes, who has signed up for a deep space colonization program as an expendable. As the film starts, he is currently on his 17th iteration of being an expendable, which is to say he has basically been cloned 17 times, each cloning coming after Mickey dies in the service of the colony. This is why he is an expendable. The colony needs somebody to die. He goes and dies. Usually this service comes in the form of absorbing massive amounts of radiation or serving as a guinea pig in a viral experiment. When we first see him, however, he has fallen to the bottom of a crevasse on the ice world of Niflheim, where he and his fellow colonists have settled. He's about to freeze to death when some helpful worm creatures carry him back to the base, where he finds Mickey 18 in his bed. Uh-oh, this is bad, because multiples are loathed by the populace, since the last guy who intentionally made multiples of himself was a serial killer. As such, they have to take turns working, hiding, and making love to girlfriend Nasha, played by Naomi Ackie, who is, and also, while doing all of this, trying to avoid the wrath of the Trump-like leader of the expedition, failed politician Kenneth Marshall, who's played by Mark Ruffalo. And while director Bong Joon-ho has denied any connection between Kenneth Marshall and Donald J. Trump, I'm not sure the costuming choices for his followers with their red besloganed hats is going to leave much room for doubt about what precisely is going on in this whole metaphor. Look, my big problem with Mickey 17 is that there's a lot of room to play with the kind of interesting idea of what happens with a guy who can be endlessly killed in the hopes of improving the lot of humanity, or more cynically, improving the lot of the corporations that are controlled by the top class of humanity, right? The tension between human flourishing and capitalism has long been a hallmark of Bong's work, particularly in the films Snowpiercer, Parasite, and Okja. And regardless of whether or not one agrees that that tension exists and is a problem, I'm skeptical, frankly. You can still make a fun movie out of it, right? The middle 40 minutes of Snowpiercer, for instance, which literalizes class warfare by having proles charge from the rear steerage class of a train to the front, killing the upper classes as they go, is some of the best filmmaking of the 2010s. Just high-octane action with a resonant thematic through line. It's really good. High quality stuff. I can't recommend it enough. Mickey 17 doesn't work for me because it doesn't do anything gonzo with the premise. It's not funny. It's not exciting. There's no real action. The movie has jettisoned all the interesting ideas about pseudo-immortality and the dangers of a post-scarcity society in favor of this incredibly limp metaphor for Trumpism and colonialism that doesn't really translate to the setting at all. The movie is both dumb and boring, which is a bad combination. I would not recommend. Your movie can be dumb or it can be boring, but it can't be dumb and boring. That's really bad. Peter, maybe we can discuss the failure of adaptations in a minute, but I want to go to Alyssa first, because I got the sense on our text thread, and I might be misreading here, that she was a little more into it than I was, certainly. Maybe you as well. I don't know. No, Alyssa, you're shaking your head. You did not care for this movie.
No, my basic feeling at the end of Mickey 17 is that the like tardigrade-like bugs who inhabit Niflheim should be allowed to take over the universe because humans are bad. I thought this was so, slow. I don't know how you guys felt about it, but I felt it like it dragged. And I think it can be an interesting premise to have a main character of your movie who's kind of an idiot. But you have to kind of understand why you as the movie viewer or people in the movie would want to spend time with that person. And I don't think the movie does this very effectively, right? I mean, the sort of a central flaw of the movie is like Mickey's an idiot, right? He gets involved in like a completely dumb scheme involving macaroons and a loan shark, and then signs up for an interplanetary mission without reading any of the fine print. And yet somehow when he's on this like spaceship to this colony, you know, a like hot security officer looks at him across the room and is like, that, I'm into that.
Well, he does look like Robert Pattinson.
Well, it's Robert Pattinson, to be fair.
True. But like, I mean, isn't it possible that like if you're Naomi Ackie's character, you would be like, you would like bang hot, dumb, you know, Mickey 17, and then not like, for example, like, you know, get into a hazmat suit and like hold him as he's being like poisoned to death and stuff. Like, I don't know. There's no reason that these characters are together or have like any emotional attachment at all. So I think that's one central problem. And then I think the second one, I think Mark Ruffalo is awful in this. He's basically rehashing work that he did sort of much better and more precisely in Poor Things. There is no sign of why this sort of obviously idiotic, uncharismatic person would have attracted a literally religious following where people would travel across the galaxy with him on this sort of like desperate mission, right? Like, I do not support almost any of Donald Trump's policies or his way of carrying out any sort of governance, but I understand why people find him sort of compelling as a performer. And I think there is nothing in Ruffalo's performance or in Toni Collette's performance that explains why any of these characters have followed this person to this planet.
It's because of the sauce.
There's a key distinction between this and Poor Things. And I had my issues with Poor Things. Poor Things also does the thing where it makes the metaphor very literal. And there's a lot of like speeches explaining why you're supposed to agree with these characters.
But Poor Things is fun.
Poor Things was funny.
Yeah.
Not just fun. Specifically, it was funny. I laughed out loud a dozen times watching that movie, despite the fact that I like largely disagreed with lots of it and parts of it were very annoying. It's a funny movie. And this movie is not funny. This movie is shockingly unfunny. It's unfunnier than Parasite. Parasite is occasionally a very funny movie. Like the situation those characters all found themselves in was kind of funny. And you can see the setup for humor throughout this movie. Like, for instance, Peter just mentioned the sauce, and that won't make any sense to anyone who hasn't seen the movie. But there's a sequence in this film where Mickey 17 goes to dinner with Mark Ruffalo and Toni Collette, and they feed him a steak and it poisons him and he's like retching on the floor, and she's going on and on about the sauces that she's made, which is this weird non sequitur, which could be funny, I guess, but is not in any way here. And this whole sequence, again, you can imagine a comedic director having a lot of fun with the idea of a guy like forcing himself to eat this thing that's killing him and like being sick all over the place. And instead, it's just a miserable slog. The whole sequence goes on forever. It goes on 5 minutes too long, and it's not funny. It's somehow not funny in any way, which I don't understand. I don't understand how you can do this.
Well, they couldn't find this movie, and they couldn't find it on set, and they couldn't find it in the edit room, and eventually they found it in the voiceover. And so one of the things that's notable about that sequence specifically, the dinner sequence, comes about halfway through the movie. It's sort of a big midpoint, like shifting of gears. Up until that point, nearly every scene has been managed via voiceover. And almost everything in this film is just told to you via a voiceover that clearly was at least heavily rewritten, if not totally written after the fact, to kind of make the edit work. This film is long delayed. It was supposed to come out at least a year ago, I believe. It was shot in 2022. And it's pretty clear to me that they shot the movie, realized they didn't have a movie, and then delayed this thing to rebuild something else after the fact. And they built it, they made it hold together. And I do think the movie more or less holds together. It's not completely incoherent. Like, you can basically follow what's going along. Well, it's coherent in the sense of, like, you can follow what's going on, but it doesn't make any sense. Like Alyssa said, it has all of these motivations that are just not in the text, that are like, why is this happening? Why is anyone doing this? What is all of this about? Because the whole movie has been re-engineered after the fact, I suspect, to get us to the Trump metaphor. Because that's the point where they stop having everything be told to you through this Pattinson voiceover. It's the point when they get to the Trump stuff. And that's a weird thing to do, is that, like, they decided that the movie they wanted to make was, this is a movie about how Trump is a braggadocious idiot with idiot followers who sort of loves to be on TV and put on shows for people, but doesn't actually know how to do management and is kind of cruel to the local flora and fauna who happen to be actually intelligent and nice. I'm sorry, spoilers. And the whole thing kind of, it's like they decided to discard all of the other elements in favor of just making that the centerpiece of the film. And that stuff doesn't work at all. Now, maybe there was a big action sequence that was awesome in the original. I doubt it. Maybe there were funny bits that were actually funny in the original. I also doubt that, or at least in the original conception. I'm not saying that there's like some hidden cut out there. I suspect there are other cuts that are rough that were made at some point. But it just feels to me like this thing was taken apart, rebuilt, stitched together in the edit room. There was even a profile of Robert Pattinson not too long ago, in which one of the things, sort of almost as a side note, that the profile writer noted was, oh, he's got to go back to, I want to say the UK, but somewhere. He's got to go back to somewhere to re-record a voiceover for his upcoming movie, Mickey 17. I'm telling you, this movie was completely re-engineered, and it was re-engineered to be held together by a voiceover that tells you what's going on throughout the first at least 50 minutes, and then frequently pops in to kind of smooth together scenes. It's a pretty good rebuilding of a movie, in the sense that most of the time when you see something like this, an obvious, like, just complete rebuild in the edit room, most of the time it's just like, what the hell is that? Most of the time you get something like some of these Star Wars projects that we've seen.
Or Madam Web.
Like Madam Web, right? Like, which, oh my God, I can't believe that movie exists and was released. But it leaves you with this thing that's just sort of like, it goes from scene to scene. And I do think that Robert Pattinson's line readings of some of those, some of the voiceover material, his line readings are so off key and so sort of weak and strange. They are a little bit funny at times. And I laughed actually at the kind of weirdness of these really little line readings where he can't quite figure out what it is he's, I don't know why I'm here either, right? It's constantly like that, even when he's saying things that you can imagine another actor who hadn't chosen to play this basically as a funny voice role would be saying with like some sort of great confidence, you know, just explaining what's going on. And he's kind of limping through it in a way that I found amusing. But the underlying scenes, like, he's constantly, the voiceover is constantly interrupting and competing with dialogue in the movie, because the stuff that people are actually saying in the scenes they shot is not worth listening to. And when they finally let a scene play out, as they do with that dinner table scene, you hear why they just wanted to get through it with a voiceover that explained what you needed to know. Because every time they let a scene play out with people actually talking to each other, it's like, what the hell are we doing here?
Ugh.
I'm genuinely kind of shocked. I don't know. Alyssa, did you read the book?
No.
All right. So Peter, you have read the book, right?
Yeah. It's been a year or so, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, it didn't come out long ago. I think it came out in 2022, something like that.
I believe that's right.
Maybe a little before that. There's a terrible form of criticism where it's like, it's not faithful enough to the source material, and that's why it's bad. And that's not quite what I want to do here. But I do think it's worth thinking about the things that were jettisoned from this story and what was introduced. So one of them being that in the book, it is very explicitly made clear to Mickey that being an expendable is a terrible, terrible thing. That the woman he goes to apply for it, like, tries to talk him out of it for multiple pages in the book. He, you know, he's like, okay. And the other reason that he is there is because he has gotten into gambling debt. It's not because he has done some failed capitalist project and, you know, taken out a silly loan. It's because he got into gambling debt because he made really bad choices. Instead of having him do this of his own volition and sound mind because he has made bad choices, and instead just making him kind of an idiot, really undermines everything else in the movie. I don't know. That's part of it. But then also there's just a jettisoning of ideas about what it would mean to live in a post-scarcity society, what it would mean to live in a future where space exploration is a regular thing, and instead just made it this very boring metaphor set 50 years in the future about Donald Trump, instead of 1,000 years in the future about, like, the potential of humanity.
Weird. One of the things they jettisoned was a near perfect, not near perfect, but a very strong kind of funny metaphor for someone like Elon Musk that could have been a criticism of Elon Musk, if that's what you want to do. Now, okay, this movie, again, was made several years ago before Elon Musk was part of the Trump government, before Trump was elected, I think even before, like, I think it was shot before Trump even announced for sure that he was running. But in the movie, the reason that multiples are banned is, as Sonny said, it's because the person who did it was a serial killer who made multiples of himself, like three, I think, that we see in the movie. In the book, the reason that multiples are banned is that I believe it was one of the inventor of the technology, but in any case, like a sort of billionaire Musk tech bro type, basically went mad and made an entire planetary civilization of himself. Yeah. And then, like, kind of started trying to conquer people. And with like just like armies of himself, and it's madcap and it's zany, and it also makes a point about, like, yeah, sort of the ambitions and awfulness of a person like this. And I say this as somebody who's probably the most sympathetic to, you know, big capitalist billionaire types on this podcast, but it's like, it's a funny bit that actually plays repeatedly into, here's why we have limits on this technology, here's you know, sort of why, like, society decided that this needed to stop. There's an actual story and motivation and an explanation, and they made a change in the script to cut that out in favor of something that doesn't add anything at all. That doesn't,
it's not,
like,
funny.
That it's not funny and doesn't give you any more material. And the other thing that the book does is, so much of the plot is just driven by the fact that the multiples are competing for calories. Yeah. And you see this mentioned, like, once and then almost entirely dropped. Like, it's sort of vaguely implied in the dinner scene, right? Like, or it's sort of, like, vaguely implied as, like, the setup for the dinner scene is, oh, everybody else is struggling with calories, you'll get to have a big dinner. But then after that, it's like, why? It's not actually part of the, it's not driving anything. But the whole middle section of the book is driven by the two, there's two of these guys. They've already had their food restricted for screwing stuff up. And also now they have to not be noticed as two of them. They can't let people know that there's two of them. So they're sneaking around and they're also, like, trying to share food. And one of them is a jerk about food. And it's all this funny stuff, but it's also, like, just kind of moment to moment plot motivation of, like, how do I get from here to there? How do I do this thing so that I can get my 550 calories for the day? Because we're on a space colony that hasn't set up food production yet, and we need to figure out how to, like, and calories are scarce. And it's just, like, all of that plot mechanic stuff, all of that motivation, all of that specifics has been removed in favor of, let's have Robert Pattinson talk in a funny voice to explain what's going on in every single scene while Mark Ruffalo does an unhinged but terribly unfunny Trump vamp.
Pretty good summary right there. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Mickey 17?
Thumbs down. Ugh.
Thumbs down. The more I think about it, the less I like it.
Thumbs down. Nah, it just did not work for me on any level, really. I don't know. It just did not work. All right, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Rupert Manderstam, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.